coming to the last chorus. Need to hear everybody singing. Are you ready?
Sweet Caroline.
Good times never seem so good.
That was Neil Diamond, who showed up yesterday to sing along in the seventh inning stretch with the song that has been the unofficial theme song for the Boston Red Sox at Fenway Park for many, many years. He showed up yesterday to show the support, and you could hear the enthusiasm of the crowd as they sang along with him, as they usually do, but it seemed like yesterday they were singing even louder, as if they were showing off their defiance to anybody who might try to do anything to their town. A very resilient city, Boston. Let's see how they're doing today. Here's Eric Moskowitz, who's a reporter for the Boston Globe. Eric, thanks for joining me on America Weekend.
Sure, glad to be here with you.
Was that essentially the tone all around Boston yesterday?
You know, largely it was, and I would say there were a lot of microclimates. For example, yesterday was the first day I had off all week after an 80-hour work week and a couple of days with no sleep, and I actually had to go retrieve my car in Watertown, where it had been inside the perimeter where the police were searching. I had raced out there following the police lights on Thursday night, early Friday morning, and ended up losing my car as a result of the search for Jahar Tarnia after the shootout. And I have a good friend who lived a block or two, and these are very short blocks, not city blocks, from where the shootout started, and then where part of it took place. And so I ended up watching the Celtics playoff game at my friend's house, where he'd spent the previous 18 hours cowering on the bedroom floor listening to the sounds of the police and waiting for the okay that he could sort of lift his head up. And, I mean, it's really surreal to be – I mean, it could have been in some ways a normal Saturday. I mean, having a beer on the couch watching the Celtics, except, you know, he had just been sort of out, you know, walking around for the first time after a sleepless night and very tense day, and then a little bit of rest, and, you know, talking to neighbors, seeing on the ground where there was, marks left by the jury-rigged explosives that the brothers had thrown, gunshots in stop signs. I mean, really, the signs of a gun battle that you don't see ever in a suburban neighborhood in the United States, where there are 200 shots fired. I mean, it's something from a war zone. And yet, you know, the sun was out. It was sort of a glorious, a little cold, but very much a spring day in New England. And, you know, stores were open. People were out. All the shops that had been closed as a result of the order were open. And I think, it's hard for people in different ways. And we need to remember that there are still 50 or so people in the hospital. And I think, people are carrying the emotional baggage in different ways. But very much, you know, outwardly, it looked like the city not just returning to normal, but sort of trying to embrace normalcy and show that, we can get back to, what Boston is and was, without terror.
Yeah, breathing a giant sigh of relief and trying to go forward while never forgetting, of course, the incidents of those 102 hours from Monday afternoon through Friday night. Take me back to Watertown, since you were there, and tell us a little bit about what the scene was like both Thursday night and on Friday during this shutdown on the streets.
Sure.
There.
And if I could, I'll wind back the clock just a little bit earlier, because, as you know, this began with the release of photos Thursday afternoon, just a few hours after that interfaith kneeling ceremony where the president came to town. And about 5 hours after the photos were released, and the photos really did kind of smoke the brothers out of they'd been hiding in plain sight. I mean, the younger brother had returned to his college campus. You know, people had been sort of joking with him, you better watch out. You know, you kind of look like the guy. So then they're smoked out by the photos, and we have this terrible scene at 10:30 Thursday night at MIT, where the police officer responding to the call is shot. And I had just gotten home after a 12-hour day. I lived pretty close to MIT. I had written a couple of stories about the victims and the service, which was really where our focus was Thursday. I raced over the MIT scene. Police are taping that off. You know, a couple of tense hours there, sort of not knowing that there's a carjacking going on nearby and it's about to precede a shootout. And so, you know, when I found out about 12:30 that this carjacking happened, it was because some of the cops, and whenever, you know, on the terrible rare occasions when you have a police officer shot, you have a huge show of force. So there were probably 50 cruisers outside of the shooting scene at MIT when I was there. And all of a sudden, you know, sort of 2 hours after this has happened, cruisers just start taking off from the MIT scene. And it's really rare to have police tearing away from a crime scene. So I thought there must be something going on. And I managed to get my car. It was sort of boxed in a little bit by the state police. And I followed the light. And, you know, they're rapidly heading out to Watertown. I mean, just one after another after another. It was as if literally every available police cruiser, I think, in Greater Boston was just flying out to Watertown to where the site of the gun battle with the brothers was occurring. And when you got there, I got there just before 1 a.m., and there hadn't been a perimeter yet set up. The gun battle just ended. They're now on foot and in car searching for the brother who'd gotten away. He had, you know, apparently driven over the ravaged body of his already mortally wounded brother, and, you know, had gotten into hiding. And they're trying to chase after him in really a densely packed residential neighborhood. I mean, on one end you have, you know, some bakeries, barbershops, that kind of thing. On the far end, you know, there's sort of bigger, big box retail. But in between you have, you know, lots of homes on, I would guess, a quarter acre, eighth of an acre, multifamily homes. So it's and sort of small, typically New England kind of windy streets. So there are a lot of, you know, nooks and crannies in the dark where this guy could hide under porches, you know, tiny sort of fenced-in yards. And the police, you know, are searching for him block by block and setting up a perimeter around this 20 street area where they think he is, while neighbors are, you know, cowering inside. And you hear, I mean, it was hard to estimate the time. It might have been sometimes every 5 minutes, sometimes every hour. You would hear a kind of, you know, sort of aggressive noise. And then otherwise it was a lot of waiting around. And at the perimeter that they had set up, you know, you quickly saw, you know, hundreds of onlookers, media from around the world, just trying to wait and see what was going on. And so, you know, occasionally there would be, I remember 1:30 a.m., there was a bang. At 1 a.m., you know, just after the gunfight, before they had set up this perimeter, I saw a dozen cops draw their guns on a house right near where I had sort of pulled up to, and they're shouting, "Get down, get down." And then immediately other cops are pushing onlookers away for safety and also to put them out of sight. I did not hear shots fired at that time, but it was indicative of the kind of tense atmosphere. I mean, you have somebody who's just been throwing explosives and shooting at the police, and he's missing. And then, you know, that led to, I may be off on an hour or two, but in sort of 18-hour, 20-hour search that leads to this backyard boat. And then they find the guy.
Yeah, finding the guy, by the way, was because a man who lives on Franklin Street in Watertown named Dave Hanaberry happened to go outside once the curtain of stay home was lifted, and he went out to, I guess, get a breath of fresh air, or maybe had a smoke, I don't know, but he saw blood on his boat and called 911. Is he being hailed as a hero now, Eric?
I mean, I can't tell you what, you know, sort of across community, what people are saying about him. I mean, but it is a really sort of remarkable turn of events. And I think, you know, I think there is a sense that everybody is glad and relieved that the stay inside honor was respected. That, first of all, people were genuinely afraid, but I also think, given the way this had shaken the community, that everybody wanted this guy to be caught.
Yeah.
And that staying inside was a way to help the police in some small fashion, you know, sort of spot any movement. I mean, at one point I was just outside the perimeter and you know, talking to residents who through their window had seen police pull over. You know, if I can sort of set the scene for you, you know, there's a Toyota Camry that makes a U-turn.
Eric, I've only got about 15 seconds here, so I got to ask you to make it quick.
Sure. So, yes, people are very relieved, and they do feel that it was sort of great move on the part of that resident to see something suspicious. And check it out.
Yep.
I mean, not necessarily to look inside, but to notify authorities.
Yeah, that was it was one of the breaks that the cops needed on Friday night. I know there's a kind of a makeshift memorial and a service going on Boylston again today as Boston continues to return to normalcy, if such a thing is possible. Eric, thanks so much for joining me today on America Weekend.
Thank you for having me.
That's Eric Moskowitz, a reporter for the Boston Globe. I'm Paul Harris. This is America Weekend on the Envision Radio Networks.